All right, everyone, buckle up.
Yeah.
We're diving deep today into the world of PCR and Sanger sequencing.
It's amazing how these techniques have become so fundamental, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, from diagnosing diseases to like cutting-edge biotech research, PCR and Sanger sequencing are everywhere.
Yeah, they really are.
And you know what I love about this?
What's that?
The source material you sent over is this awesome university-level microbiology course guide, specifically Module 4, from a course called Antibiotic Resistance Lab. Sounds intimidating, right?
It does sound a bit complex, yeah.
But by the end of this deep dive, we're all going to be like mini experts.
That's the goal, demystifying these powerful tools.
I love it. So can you give us a quick rundown of what we're going to be exploring today?
Well, we'll be uncovering how PCR basically acts as a DNA copying machine, and then how Sanger sequencing allows us to actually read the genetic code, the precise order of those A's, T's, C's, and G's.
So PCR, like making millions of copies of a specific page from a giant instruction manual. And Sanger sequencing is like carefully reading each word on that page.
Perfect analogy.
But before we get to the copying and reading, shouldn't we make sure we're all on the same page about, well, DNA structure itself?
Right, let's do a quick review. So picture DNA as a ladder twisted into a spiral staircase that's the famous double helix. Each rung of the ladder is made of two molecules called nucleotides. They're like the letters of the genetic alphabet.
And there are four different letters, right? Adenine, thymine, cytosine, and guanine, or A, T, C, and G for short.
Exactly. And they always pair up in a specific way, A with T and C with G, forming those ladder rungs. It's the sequence of base pairs that holds the instructions for building and maintaining an organism.
Gotcha. So it's not just a random jumble of letters. The order matters. But what about this directionality thing I keep seeing in the notes? It sounds like DNA is a one-way street.
It kind of is. Each strand of the DNA double helix has a direction, like an arrow, you know? We call one end 5' and the other 3'. It's all about the chemical structure, but the main takeaway is that this directionality is essential for DNA replication and reading the code.
Okay, so DNA polymerase, the enzyme that copies DNA, can only work in one direction.
Yeah, it's like a train that can only travel on one track.
That makes sense.
And you know, another interesting thing.
Tell me.
The bond between C and G is actually a bit stronger than the bond between A and T.
Wait, really? Why is that?
Well, C and G pair up with 3 hydrogen bonds, while A and T only have 2.
Ah, so an extra bond makes it stronger. Makes sense.
It's a subtle difference, but it affects things like DNA stability and melting temperature, which we'll talk about later.
Wow, it's those little details that often make a big difference.
Okay.
Okay, so now we've got the basics of DNA structure down. Let's get to the main event, PCR. From what I understand, it's basically a molecular photocopier that can make millions of copies of a specific DNA sequence.
It is. Imagine you have this tiny sample of DNA, maybe just a few cells. PCR allows you to zoom in on a specific region of that DNA and make enough copies to study it in detail.
It's like finding a needle in a haystack and then making millions of copies of that needle. Pretty amazing. But how does it actually work? What are the key ingredients in this molecular copy machine?
The stars of the show are DNA polymerase, primers, DNTTs, and of course, the DNA sample itself.
Okay, so we've got our DNA polymerase, which is like the copy machine. What about those other things, primers, DNTPs?
Primers are short sequences of DNA, and they act like bookmarks, telling the DNA polymerase exactly where to start copying.
So they're setting the boundaries, making sure we're only copying the page we want.
Exactly. Then we've got DNTPs, which are like the individual building blocks, the A's, T's, C's, and G's. The polymerase uses these to build the new DNA strands.
Like a big bucket of Lego bricks.
Exactly. And of course, the template DNA is like the original instruction manual we're copying.
All right, so we have the players. What happens next?
Well, the PCR process involves repeating a cycle of 3 steps, each at a specific temperature, melting, annealing, and extension.
Okay, a temperature-controlled molecular dance. I'm intrigued. Break it down for me.
So the first step is melting, where we heat the DNA to over 90 degrees Celsius.
That's hot.
It is. That's how we break the hydrogen bonds holding those two DNA strands together, causing them to separate, like unzipping a zipper.
So we're basically creating 2 single strands of DNA ready to be copied.
Precisely. Next, we lower the temperature down to about 50 to 65 degrees Celsius for the annealing step. This is where those primers we talked about come in. They bind to their complementary sequences on the separated DNA strands.
Like each primer is finding its perfect match, marking the start and end points for copying.
A great analogy. And finally, we raise the temperature again, this time to around 72 degrees Celsius for the extension step. This is where DNA polymerase really shines. It attaches to the primer and starts adding those dNTPs, building a brand new DNA strand.
Amazing. We're using the original DNA strand as a template to build a new one.
Mm.
And this whole cycle, melting, annealing, extending, it just keeps repeating.
Exactly. Each cycle doubles the amount of DNA. After, say, 20 or 30 cycles, you've got millions of copies of that specific DNA sequence.
That's why it's called polymerase chain reaction. Makes perfect sense. But wouldn't there be a risk of errors with all this copying going on? You know, like making a copy of a copy, things can get blurry.
That's a really good point.
Yeah.
And that brings us to a crucial detail, the DNA polymerase itself.
Okay, what about it?
Well, early PCR techniques used DNA polymerases that weren't very stable at high temperatures. You had to add fresh enzyme after each melting step. But then came TAC polymerase.
TAC polymerase.
Yeah, it's derived from a bacterium called Thermus aquaticus, which lives in hot springs.
Oh, wow, so it's used to the heat.
Exactly. So TAC polymerase is naturally adapted to withstand high temperatures, meaning it can survive those 90-degree melting steps.
Brilliant. So TAC polymerase is our high-temperature hero, churning out copies of DNA without falling apart. But I'm still thinking about those potential errors. How do we make sure our copies are actually accurate?
Well, even TAC polymerase can make occasional mistakes when copying DNA. You know, it's not perfect. But luckily, we now have high-fidelity DNA polymerases with something called proofreading mechanisms.
Proofreading. Like double-checking their work as they go.
Exactly. They can detect and correct most errors, ensuring that the amplified DNA is a faithful copy of the original.
Incredible. Like a spell checker for DNA.
Okay.
So now we have all these copies of a specific DNA sequence. But what's next? How do we actually decipher the code and understand what those A's, T's, C's, and G's are telling us?
That's where Sanger sequencing comes in, and that's where we'll pick up in the next part of our deep dive.
Ooh, can't wait. Stay tuned, everyone.
Welcome back to our deep dive. Last time we were talking about PCR and making all those copies of DNA, remember?
Yeah, it's like having a molecular photocopier.
Right. But we left off with a big question. How do we actually read that DNA code after it's been amplified? You know, like what do all those A's, T's, C's, and G's actually tell us?
Yeah, that's what I was wondering too. It's like we've got these millions of copies, but they're written in a language we don't understand.
Exactly. And that's where Sanger sequencing comes in.
Okay, so Sanger sequencing is like our translator.
You could say that. It's a technique that lets us figure out the exact order of those A's, T's, C's, and G's in a DNA sequence.
So going from photocopying to actually reading the text.
Exactly. It's pretty cool. And it actually shares some similarities with PCR, but there are a few key differences.
Oh, like what?
Well, first of all, remember how we used two primers in PCR?
Yeah, to kind of mark the beginning and end of the section we want to copy.
Right. Well, in Sanger sequencing, we only use one primer.
Interesting. So we're just focusing on copying one strand of the DNA this time.
That's right. And the other big difference is we use these special nucleotides called DDNTPs.
DDNTPs. Okay. What are those?
They're similar to the regular DNTPs, the building blocks of DNA, but with a little twist. When a DDNTP gets added to a growing DNA strand, it basically acts like a stop sign.
Wait, a stop sign? So the DNA polymerase just stops copying?
Exactly. It hits that DDNTP and it's like, all right, that's it. I'm done.
Okay, so how does that help us figure out the sequence?
Well, here's the really clever part. Each of the four DDNTPs, the ones that stop at A, T, C, and G, they're each labeled with a different fluorescent color.
Ooh, color-coded stop signs. I like it.
Yeah. So we set up the sequencing reaction in a way that gives us a whole bunch of DNA fragments, all of different lengths, and each one ends with a fluorescently labeled DDNTP.
So some fragments might be like 10 nucleotides long, others 15, others 20, and so on. And the color at the end tells us what that last nucleotide is.
Exactly. We're getting it.
Cool. So what happens next?
Well, then we separate all these fragments by size using a technique called capillary electrophoresis. It's basically like a tiny racetrack for DNA.
Okay, so the shorter fragments will zoom ahead of the longer ones.
Exactly. And as each fragment crosses the finish line, so to speak, there is a detector that reads its fluorescent tag. That tells us what nucleotide is at the end of that fragment.
So we get this readout of colors, like a barcode almost, that corresponds to the sequence of nucleotides in our DNA strand.
That's a great way to think about it. And that's basically the essence of Sanger sequencing. It's how we went from knowing DNA had a code to actually being able to read that code.
It's incredible, really. No wonder Frederick Sanger won a Nobel Prize for this. Okay, so we've talked about PCR, which is like our DNA photocopier, and Sanger sequencing, which helps us read the code. What else is there to explore in this molecular toolbox?
Well, remember how we talked about those CG bonds being stronger than AT bonds?
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting.
Well, that little difference in bond strength actually comes into play in a variation of PCR called quantitative PCR, or qPCR for short.
Quantitative PCR. Okay, so this isn't just about detecting if a DNA sequence is there or not. It's actually about measuring how much is there.
Exactly. qPCR is like adding a measuring cup to our DNA photocopier, you know? It lets us figure out the starting amount of DNA in a sample.
Okay, that sounds super useful. How does qPCR actually work?
Well, there are a couple of different ways to do it, but one common method uses a fluorescent dye that binds specifically to double-stranded DNA. So as those new DNA strands are made during PCR, more of the dye binds and the fluorescent signal gets stronger.
So basically, the brighter the glow, the more DNA there is.
Precisely. And the cool thing is, we can actually monitor that fluorescence in real time as the PCR cycles are happening.
That's so cool. It's like watching the DNA multiply before our eyes and seeing a number for how much is being made.
Exactly. And that number, that quantitative data, is what allows us to do things like track the progression of a viral infection, you know, by measuring how much viral DNA is in a patient's blood.
So a higher viral load would mean a stronger fluorescent signal.
Yep. And potentially a more severe infection. qPCR is also widely used in research to measure gene expression levels.
Oh yeah, gene expression. So we're talking about how active a gene is, right? Like how much of its protein product is being made.
You got it. And remember, genes are basically like recipes for making proteins. The amount of protein a cell makes depends on how often that recipe is being used, so to speak.
Right. So how does qPCR help us with that?
Well, remember mRNA, the messenger molecule? The one that carries the instructions from DNA to the protein-making machinery in the cell.
Yeah, it's like the transcript of the recipe.
Exactly. Well, we can use qPCR to measure how much of a specific mRNA is present, and that gives us a good indication of how active a particular gene is.
So more mRNA means the gene is being transcribed more, and that means more protein is being made.
Exactly. And that's how we can study things like how gene activity changes in response to different drugs or environmental factors or even different stages of development.
Wow. We're really getting a glimpse into the inner workings of the cell here. Pretty amazing.
It is. But there's one more variation of PCR I want to mention, one that lets us study not just DNA, but also RNA.
Wait, RNA? But PCR works with DNA.
Right, but that's where reverse transcription PCR or RQ-PCR comes in. It's a technique that allows us to study RNA molecules like mRNA or even the genomes of RNA viruses.
Whoa, we're going even deeper into the molecular world now.
Exactly. And the key to RT-PCR is an enzyme called reverse transcriptase.
Reverse transcriptase. So it's like the opposite of transcription. Instead of going from DNA to RNA, we're going from RNA to DNA.
You got it. Reverse transcriptase basically uses an RNA molecule as a template to build a complementary DNA strand, and we call that cDNA.
So we're converting the RNA into a DNA format that we can then use in our regular PCR.
That's right. Once we have that cDNA, we can amplify it using PCR, just like any other DNA sequence.
Mind blown. So RT-PCR opens up a whole new set of possibilities. We can study RNA viruses like the flu or HIV. We can quantify mRNA levels to understand gene expression. The possibilities seem endless.
And just like regular PCR, there's a quantitative version of RT-PCR too. We call it RT-qPCR. And it lets us measure the amount of specific RNA molecules in a sample, which gives us even more insight into how genes are expressed and regulated.
This is really revolutionary. We've gone from simply amplifying DNA to quantifying DNA and RNA, and even studying RNA viruses. It's incredible how these different variations of PCR have expanded our understanding of the molecular world.
And don't forget that research paper you sent over, the one about MRSA.
Yeah, the one about antibiotic resistance.
Right. They used RT-qPCR to study how something called bicarbonate impacts antibiotic resistance gene expression in different strains of MRSA.
Oh, yeah. By measuring the levels of specific mRNA molecules, they could see how the activity of certain genes changed when bicarbonate was present.
Pretty cool.
It is. And that kind of research could really help us figure out new ways to fight antibiotic resistance, which is a huge problem.
It's amazing to think that a technique as seemingly simple as copying DNA has led to such incredible advancements. I know, right? It really shows the power of scientific curiosity and innovation. But I'm curious, what do you think is the most remarkable thing about this whole evolution of PCR?
That's a good question. I think for me, it's the elegance and simplicity of the core concept. We're basically harnessing the natural machinery of DNA replication and using it to create this incredibly powerful tool that's transformed biology and medicine.
I totally agree. It's like we've learned to speak the language of life itself, you know?
I love that.
Yeah.
And on that note, I think it's time to move on to our final part, where we'll talk about the even broader applications of PCR and Sanger sequencing and, you know, what the future might hold for these amazing techniques. And we're back for the final part of our deep dive into PCR and Sanger sequencing.
It's amazing how these techniques have revolutionized so many different fields, isn't it?
It really is. And speaking of revelations, let's talk about some real-world applications of these techniques.
Yeah.
We've touched on a few, but I want to hear more about how PCR and Sanger sequencing are being used, you know, in medicine, agriculture, forensics.
Oh, absolutely. Well, in medicine, they've been game changers. They've allowed us to develop genetic tests for a whole range of diseases, from inherited conditions like cystic fibrosis to infectious diseases like HIV.
Right. And remember how we were talking about qPCR and measuring viral load?
Yeah.
That's become a crucial tool for monitoring patients with chronic infections.
Yeah.
It helps doctors figure out the best treatment.
Exactly. And with this whole rise of personalized medicine, PCR and Sanger sequencing are playing a bigger and bigger role in making sure treatments are tailored to an individual's genetic makeup.
It's like moving away from that one-size-fits-all approach to medicine and towards something much more targeted and effective.
Exactly. And beyond just diagnosing and treating diseases, PCR and Sanger sequencing are also being used in drug discovery and development. Researchers can study how genes are expressed, you know, in response to different drugs, and that helps them identify new targets for drug development, or even optimize how well existing drugs work.
It's like having a molecular magnifying glass to guide drug development.
It is, and it's not just human health that's benefiting from these technologies. In agriculture, PCR is used to, like, detect plant pathogens, identify genetically modified organisms, even assess the genetic diversity of crops.
Wow, so PCR is helping to ensure food safety, improve crop yields, even preserve biodiversity. That's incredible.
It is. And let's not forget forensic science. PCR and Sanger sequencing have revolutionized that field as well.
Oh, yeah. They're like essential tools for DNA fingerprinting now, right?
Exactly. Helping to solve crimes, identify victims, even exonerate people who were wrongly convicted.
I've always been fascinated by forensic science. And it's mind-blowing to think that something as simple as copying DNA can have such a huge impact on justice.
I know. It really shows the power of molecular biology to unravel mysteries and reveal the truth, even from the tiniest pieces of evidence.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's not just these, like, established fields that are being impacted. New applications are popping up all the time. Environmental monitoring, evolutionary biology, even archaeology.
Yeah, it's really incredible. We're using these techniques to study ancient DNA, track how infectious diseases spread, monitor pollution levels, even identify new species.
It's amazing to think about. It's like we've unlocked a whole new way of understanding the world around us, from the smallest molecules to, like, entire ecosystems. It really makes you wonder, where do you see these techniques taking us in the future?
Ooh, that's a great question. I mean, just imagine a world where personalized medicine isn't just a concept, but a reality, where we can diagnose diseases before any symptoms even show up, develop incredibly targeted therapies based on an individual's genes, maybe even engineer organisms to, like, tackle climate change or improve food security.
Those are some really inspiring possibilities. And it's all thanks to the scientists who, you know, had the curiosity to dive into this molecular world, armed with tools like PCR and Sanger sequencing.
And remember, this journey of discovery isn't over. New variations and applications are being developed all the time, pushing the boundaries of what we thought was even possible.
Absolutely. It just goes to show science is a never-ending quest for knowledge. Right? There's always something new to explore and understand.
Couldn't agree more. So keep those brains buzzing, everyone, and never stop exploring the world around you.
And don't forget to check out the show notes for more information and resources. That way you can continue your own deep dive into PCR and Sanger sequencing.
Until next time. This is The Deep Dive signing off.